C1OB. Number 1B.
Also, if we take the other term that she uses here, coherency, what is the definition of coherent? Making a logical whole. Can you hear the holism that she is bringing out? Naturally, a third time, the term holism was not known. It's a term that was coined in the 20s, I think, by General Smuts of South Africa. He was the father, so to say, of a holistic view. And since then, we know that holism has become a main aspect of science, just mostly now today, where you have where you hear in every branch of science that only a holistic view is right, and not a atomistic view. Atomistic, taking each part, each sentence as something standing on its own. So, Mrs. Eddy therefore says that only if we have a consistent or coherent sense of the parts, that only then the statements are not contradictory. This chapter is mainly dealing with contradictions, and therefore Mrs. Eddy must put forth that her statements are not contradictory. She says, I just quote a few passages, you don't need to write them down, just to impress your thought that I'm true to the text, that I don't make up things. She will say, there are no contradictory statements in the textbook. If, she makes an if, she says they can be contradictory. If one understands its propositions. You see that you have to have an understanding of the proposition, of the roots of it, and only then they don't appear contradictory. Because it says science is not contradictory. Christian Science is not made up of contradictory aphorisms. And so the scripture and the textbook appear only contradictory if one detaches sentences or clauses, separating them from their context. So the student of the science of Christian Science, you see, he is not the student that just opens the textbook somewhere and reads a sentence and then goes to 50 pages further on and then reads again a paragraph and then goes back another 200 pages and reads another paragraph. The student of Christian Science, therefore, must read the textbook always as coming out from one root, therefore coming out from one matrix of immortality, the matrix of that is seen in its categorization of the 4x4 and giving the place value of a chapter, the chapter bringing forth branches being built up, say, through the 7 or through the 4, and only in this way you can place really a sentence in its right place, and therefore interpret it from the whole, and not just interpret a sentence as it appears to the individual inspiration. We also know that she says here that this criticism, therefore, would try to prevent, to elevate theoretical Christianity to a practical Christianity. Here she will show that really a real theory is the most practical thing you can have. That if the theory is right, then the practice will be right. That the practice lies really in being practical about finding the right theories and seeing the theory properly. You know that the fundamental point in any science is that there is nothing more practical than a good theory. and that there is nothing as impractical as a practice without theory. So we must see that here this chapter tries to show that the theory must be consistent, and that therefore we go out from a consistent theory, and only then when the theory is consistent, that is the most practical thing we can have. Therefore we are not astounded that it is especially in this chapter that he always brings out that if the statements are right, that will always lead to proof. And the other way around, that if we have proof, that leads to a true statement. So it goes both ways, that here the text is full, that statement must be followed by proof, that proof is essential, that mere opinions are valueless, proof and demonstration instead of opinion are summoned to support Christian Science, proving the word by the deeds. When the omnipotence of God is preached and his absoluteness is set forth, see, that's again the theory, Christian Science sermon will heal the sick. It will prove itself. And again she says that the words of divine science find their immortality in deeds. And inconsistency, the opposite of that consistency, is shown by words without deeds. So here we have a great sense of how she shows that theoretical Christianity can be made and elevated to practical Christianity then when there are no contradictions, no inconsistency in the theory. She also says that proofs really lead to understanding and to true statements. She says, by their fruits we shall know them. Well, that's naturally what every religion tells us. What every metaphysical group and semi-metaphysical group of today tells us. They all say we have fruits and you can know us that we are ripe by the fruits. But Mrs. Eddy meant, look at the fruits and see from which statement they come. Therefore, she says here, Jesus' words were the offspring of his deeds. Not the other way around. You see, that Jesus' words were explaining the deeds, were the offspring of his deeds, both of which must be understood. Unless the works are comprehended, which his words explained, the words are blind. And it's actually so that Mrs. Eddy says that the disciples of Jesus only began to understand Jesus when they saw the proof he has given at the point of resurrection, that only then they began to understand. So that proofs really can lead to statement and to understanding. Yes. So, can you see what here is shown? At the point of Christianity, as Christianity, it will show that pure reflection or understanding is demonstration. These are what is called here in this chapter the two key notes. Demonstration and spiritual understanding are God's immortal keynotes. Always a good hint for what a chapter wants to tell us. It can usually be deduced in most cases by comparing the beginning of a chapter with the end of a chapter. Because the beginning of a chapter would usually show the proposition that is under discussion. The end of the chapter would usually show the solution of this proposition. Here we have a very good case in this chapter, because the beginning of the chapter, we could see that her main concern was that there are only objections and criticisms because sentences and clauses were separated from their context. Separate, that there was not a one big unity. But she ends that whole chapter with a sense of terrific unity. You know, she ends there towards the end of the last page with a great statement of monism, of spiritual monism. I and my Father are one, not separated. The drop of water is one with the ocean, not separated. The ray of light is one with the sun, it's not separated. And God and man are one in being. Father and Son are one in being. Can you see how at the end she shows the solution really is when we see that everything is integrated into the one Father, into the one being, so that there is no separation between principle and idea, that everything is a coherent, consistent oneness of being. So how can we therefore see that from the initial point of the criticism of being inconsistent, we arrive at that consistency at the end of the chapter? Well, that is the office of the seven main subjects that now run through the chapter. Each one of those subjects show the argument that could pop up, the objection that can pop up in our consciousness that would disrupt the unity of the whole. Well, that would be the introduction, and I would now therefore like to go back to the biblical, to the scriptural note at the beginning of the chapter. And I think, having first read the introductory paragraph, I think it is easier now to understand those scriptural notes. The first one is, "And because I tell you the truth, ye believe me not." Ye believe me not. So they have objection. "Which of you convinces me of sin?" In the German translation, it's quite nice. It says, "Who convinces me of one sin?" He would consider it quite enough if only at one point he would not tell the truth. He would be wrong, because he could see that if in a big calculation only one calculation is made wrong, the whole is wrong. So that we can see there must be an absolute consistency of all the truths that are linked together into one whole. "And if I say the truth, why do ye not believe me?" Again, it's the question that she raises. Why do you have objections against elevating theoretical Christianity to a practical Christianity? Because one does not want to admit the truth of Christian Science, that the truth is practical. That was the main objection that they had at Jesus' time. It was the main objection at Mrs. Eddy's time, that the theory is practical, that truth is practical. They did not want to believe in it. The answer is really given in the next scriptural note. Why they don't believe in him, why they don't believe in the truth that he was demonstrating. He gave the proof of the truth, but they did not believe it. Why did they not believe it? And the answer is in the next one. But, you see, but, now you get the but. So to say, I can answer you if you listen to the following thing. But if the Spirit of him that raised up Jesus from the dead dwell in you. He that raised up Christ, actually should naturally read, he that raised up Jesus, but that's how the old manuscripts sometimes were miscopied. He that raised up Christ from the dead shall also quicken your mortal bodies by what? By his Spirit that dwelleth in you. Can you see what he says? Why there is objection? Why they didn't believe him in spite that he was proving the truth? He had the truth, and he said, I have the truth. You can't tell me not one single thing that is not true, and yet you do not believe me. Why not? And he says, because you have not the Spirit of God dwelling within you. Now, what is the Spirit of God? We know that the Spirit of God, as Mrs. Eddy explained, Spirit is that quality of infinite pure reflection. So that if everything within us reflects God, if the Spirit dwells in us, if within us there is pure reflection, where there is not one extraneous, not one foreign element entering in, not one unscientific element entering in, then this has the quality of pure reflection. And what does he say? When we have that Spirit of God within us, that it will also quicken our mortal bodies. It will heal. It will demonstrate itself. So again, that in biblical language, really Paul would say the same thing. It says, reflection is demonstration. And as long as there is no pure reflection within you, you cannot understand, you do not understand the truth. Therefore, you criticize truth, nor can you demonstrate truth, and therefore you don't believe in truth. Is that clear? That those two paragraphs actually present what? First, the point of view of truth, and the second paragraph says, and that truth you can only understand if you have the Spirit of God dwelling in you at the point of Spirit, of pure understanding, of pure reflection. So that demonstration is a matter of reflection or understanding. The Spirit really, you see, is that which enables us to demonstrate. Now we could see how in the platform that we have considered yesterday, the main point was really Spirit, namely the purity of Spirit, the purity of Christianity, the calculus of Spirit. So as if we would say, well, if you see how every truth, small t, is operating within one divine infinite calculus without friction, without opposition, without contradictions, if you see that the calculus of Spirit is operating within you, what is that? It means that it heals you, that it demonstrates you. It not only heals you, it also prevents you. It is also prevents you from getting sick. It's a preventive consciousness, that spiritual consciousness. So, we will see then as we go through the, or as you go through the text and try to read the text and see what are the main seven subjects of objections. The objections of mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love coming in. That you will see that all through the text, you always have that combination of truth and spirit and truth going right through the whole text. So don't be sidetracked in the interpretation of the seven subjects that follow through the very constant use of those two terms, truth and spirit, because she has to bring out constantly that terrific scriptural note, the highest hierarchy of what she is using, namely that understanding spirit is demonstration truth. Yes, that's what we had here. I just can quickly point out the standpoint. Yes, we have here at the beginning of our study material, we have the standpoint of the chapter. I think I have been able up to this point to explain that standpoint of the chapter. Namely, it is Christianity as Christianity. Christianity from the absolute standpoint is pure reflection, as we had yesterday, pure reflection. From a relative standpoint, Christianity on the level of Christian Science is demonstration. So that Christianity as Christianity at this point is really showing that reflection is demonstration. And the subjects, therefore, will tell us what we should do, or what are the difficulties, the dangers that would like to deflect that reflection, that will bring in a deflection. These criticisms, these objections, are all arguments that would destroy the pure reflection within ourselves and bring in arguments and criticisms that bring forth a deflection, and therefore that consciousness cannot demonstrate Christian Science. So this would be the general tone of the chapter. And therefore, the following subjects built up in the word order. Mrs. Eddy would take in seven subjects following the tonality of mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love, and would show that each one of these seven synonymous terms must be seen in their pure reflection, and that the criticisms that are voiced are all the opposite of mind, or of spirit, or of soul, or of principle, or of life, or of truth, or of love. That these are arguments within each student, difficulties that each student has with his own consciousness. And therefore, by bringing them to the surface and showing what these difficulties are, naturally the student is able to correct it. They are seven subjects, and the general tone in it would therefore be to underline her introductory statement, namely to underline what is it that prevents really theoretical Christianity to become practical Christianity. It is usually a lack of understanding, therefore, mind, or a lack of understanding something about spirit, or something about soul, or principle, or life, or truth, and love, and therefore, in that way, the epitomes are written. Perhaps so that we have an overall view, perhaps we just first read these seven epitomes on the seven synonymous term in your study material, namely those that are printed in bold letters. And we just run through them just to get the general feel of it. See, in mind, we would say, what is that which is lacking in order to raise practical theoretical Christianity to practical Christianity. It would be the opposite of mind, namely a lack of scientific, logical reasoning, like ignorance or mere opinions. Can you see these are the opposite of mind? They would deny Christian Science the power of demonstration. What is it in spirit? Another lack, namely the opposite of spirit, namely the inability to distinguish between the spiritual and material concept. That would rob Christianity of its demonstrability. You know, spirit as that which is the firmament, which can separate between the spiritual and the material. And the lack of that ability prevents demonstration. In soul, she shows the counterfeit of soul, namely without spiritual sense, the demonstrability of Christian Science cannot be perceived either. It needs soul sense. Therefore, the criticism comes because we use not spiritual sense, but material sense. In principle, we would have to find something that is the opposite of principle, namely with insufficient trust in the divine principle. It is impossible to demonstrate Christian Science, because principle demands that it is foundational, and therefore that we rest entirely on the foundation of principle. We come to life. The opposite of life is what? The lack of understanding that materialism must be given up for the love of spiritual life. And if that is not there, that impedes our demonstration. So life is always demanding to lay down the mortal sense of life. And if we don't lay down the mortal sense of life, and we want to have materialism improved, we cannot demonstrate Christian Science, and Christian Science seems contradictory. And if we come to truth, the opposite of truth is lack of consistent thought and action. Truth is whole, and therefore demands wholeness, consistency, and if that is not observed, then this obstructs the demonstration of Christian Science again. And if we come to the last subject, love, it is the lack of inner consistency in our understanding that there is only one being. This will prevent our demonstration of the one Christianity. Love always says, I am the all, and there is nothing beside me. And therefore, if we don't have a sense of that all-inclusiveness of love, of the oneness of love, we are again not in a position to demonstrate the wholeness of God.